All right, Chariot Developer News, episode number 36 for, what is it, Tuesday, June 14th, 2011. I'm Ken Rimple, and I have with me Kevin Griffin from Chariot Solutions.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, Kevin is filling in a little bit today for Eric Snyder, who will call on assignment. That's probably the best term, because he is on assignment, and it's hard for him to break away to do the dev news right now. So, Kevin, your specialty is right now mobile. You're getting into doing all sorts of mobile stuff, right?
Yeah, right now we have a couple of iOS projects going. We have a couple of Android projects going, and we're looking to add to that in the future. And so I've been very fortunate over the last year to be able to focus on an emerging space and one that's rapidly growing. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're going to do, we're going to go through a few developer news items, and then I want to kind of talk to you a little bit. One of the things that just recently came out was iOS 5 in beta form. Now, obviously, we can't talk about the internals of it because there's a gag rule on speaking about the beta, right? So we certainly don't want to end up in Apple jail.
No, but we can certainly go over the list of features that were announced by Apple at WWDC and how they impact sort of development moving forward, and some of the things that, you know, a lot of people see has been missing from the get-go from iOS.
Right. So actually, why don't we start with that? Because it makes more sense since I have you for a limited amount of time. So we'll go to the press release here. So iOS 5, and they're talking about this coming out sometime in the early fall, right?
Yep. I mean, usually it tends to lie in early September. Usually in line with a new phone, which obviously we're expecting the iPhone 5, and there's even still rumor about what hardware is involved or will be involved. If there will be new hardware, will there be an NFC chip? A lot of people think there won't be. I would really like it if there would be one.
So to translate NFC, the near field communication, this is where you take a phone and you swipe it near some sort of reader or some sort of RFID tag or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, basically you touch the phone to a tag, and if everything's set up correctly, you can read data, a small amount of data, depending on the size of the tag, from the tag to the phone. And Google coined it best in their Google I/O. They said it's a physical action with a virtual reaction. So you're physically moving the phone to a tag, and you know that tag invokes a response by your phone, usually opening up an application, could be sharing data, opening up YouTube. You know, the potential for it is massive, not just mobile payments, which is where a lot of the focus is right now for NFC. But, you know, that's a rumor that maybe it'll be in the iPhone 5. There's been no indication that there will be, so.
Yeah, who knows, right? Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things is, and this is completely side, though, is, you know, you go to Starbucks, and they have that little Starbucks app, and they were smart enough. I think it was brilliant. And it just has a little, I guess, barcode.
Yes, on the screen.
And you purchase your coffee with that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
It's simple. It's not near field. It's a really brilliant solution.
It is. It's such a simple solution to this, you know, mobile payments issue.
And
you know, they did it in a really nice way. But, you know, Google obviously got in bed with MasterCard. Was it MasterCard? Citibank.
Okay.
You get it. They are going to produce a payment method using the Nexus S and the Citibank MasterCard, and it seems like a fairly niche market to me. I mean, Nexus S isn't a phone that you go to the AT&T store and get. It's still a developer device. But it's interesting to see where they're going to take that and how many more Android devices will come out with NFC, because they have that SDK available for you in the version 10 of the SDKs.
Oh, okay.
They're there, and the APIs are robust, and we actually done some prototyping for a PhoneGap NFC plugin. So there you go. So it's definitely there. It's whether or not Apple chooses to follow. They probably won't.
Right. PhoneGap, we might as well do some definitions while we're going along. So PhoneGap, for people who haven't seen Kevin speak and talk about this, is a way of wrapping, I guess, HTML5 applications in native applications on different phones.
Exactly, yeah. They offer a wrapper. Basically, you have your HTML5, CSS3, JavaScript assets.
Right.
And they run inside a web view on the device. But PhoneGap obviously bundles all that together and allows you then to submit it to the App Store or the Android Marketplace, what have you. So.
And it also gives you like little widgets or JavaScript objects for things like your GPS location, your camera, your features in the device, right?
Yep, there is a JavaScript library available, so you can access certain device features. And you know, well, the best thing about PhoneGap being open source is that, you know, we started playing with NFC in Android, and there wasn't a plugin, so we thought, well, we could just write one. And then send it back to those guys. So we're just working on tidying up some loose ends now. And
so you actually have it working then?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a limited subset of NFC functionality.
Sure, yeah.
Because we made some decisions along the way, but maybe that's a separate podcast.
Yeah, we'll do that on a separate podcast. All right, so let's go into some of the features that they've announced for. So I guess iOS 5 is tightly tied to Lion's release, right? Or at least it's going to have features that Lion's going to take advantage of, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, They're kind of rolling a lot of the iOS stuff into Lion. Mm-hmm. You know, the swiping for changing applications and
So you do the number of fingers you use, and you can do that on the trackpad as well as on the phone, or the iPad rather.
Full screen apps is another one. You know, similar to the way every iOS app runs, you know, full screen. So, some of the features they released, I mean, the big one, obviously, the big one for me was the notifications. Notifications do suck on iOS 4. They're obtrusive.
Right.
If you walk away from your phone, as occasionally I do, and you'll come back and there'll be 12 notifications, and you have to click through them all and close them, but you're just hammering through them, so now you've lost what was there and you don't remember because you were just angry that you had 12 of them.
Yeah.
And so what they've said to us is that, you know, hey, they're going to put in this notification center. Developers, you know, can make use of the API and it's going to just tidy it up. And I think a lot of the inspiration may have come from Android. I saw Windows
phone. Everyone likes that notification system.
Those notification systems, it's awesome.
It's pretty sweet, yeah.
I saw a Windows Phone 7 blog, and I forget which one it was, but they said, you know, they were flattered by the amount of stuff that iOS had taken from Windows Phone 7. I saw a lot of it more from Android myself.
Yeah.
So certainly the notifications is a welcome addition to the phone. It's certainly going to make that whole thing a lot easier to deal with and more useful, I think, is the best thing. It's going to make developers are going to be less tentative when coming dealing with the notifications. If they know they're going to be handled in an intuitive way by the OS, it's going to collect them and organize them, and then you can act on them in a safe environment without just having close or view, which is the only kind of options you have before.
Right. Very cool. So notifications, they'll even be available on the lock screen, which is really nice. So.
Yeah. I mean, before you had to jailbreak your phone, and I forget the name of whatever app, but, it's been around for a while. It's just, you know, Apple have decided that it's okay for us to have them now. So.
Right. Okay. So then what else, let's see, we want to talk about. So this iMessage, this is like BlackBerry chat for iPhone, without BlackBerry?
Yeah, I guess so. I was actually kind of stumped. I mean, a lot of people said, oh, it's genius, you know, it's going to kill, you know, whatever, Google Talk. And it'll only work between two iOS 5 devices from my brief understanding.
Well, it makes sense if it's going to be their own protocol and it's not in the older iOS.
So, I mean, yeah, great. I wasn't overly fussed about it. It was one of the ones that came up and I was like, really? Okay, fine.
I can see if you and your wife, let's say, have two iPhone 5s.
Yeah,
which
maybe.
We're going to at some point get, you know. And then you could text without having to eat text messages, I suppose.
Yeah, I think the photo, you know, sending photos is obviously nice. You know, I don't want to pay $1.50 for MMSs or whatever it is.
I still don't have the occasion to use the, the video chat feature.
Oh, the FaceTime
thing? Yeah, I haven't really used FaceTime.
Really?
Have you?
We bought my sister-in-law. Baby sister-in-law an iPod Touch for Christmas.
Oh yeah,
every night FaceTime calls, and it's great because, you know, they live on separate sides of the state, and she wants to talk to her sister, so she fires her face just like the commercial. Actually, it's very sweet.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah. Well, there's your use case right there.
Yeah, exactly. So they got that one right.
Let's see the other major ones with the things, like there's a little reminder center.
Yeah, there's a to-do list. Basically, it's going to be a new application. It's a reminders application. It's kind of like a to-do list. One of the things that I believe they mentioned, and I'm going to make sure that I don't do the NDA thing.
Oh, we're looking here.
Is that they will geofence locations for you. So as you approach a location, it'll flag you and say, you know,
that'd be nice.
Whatever, you know, or when you're leaving, imagine you're leaving work and it's like you have to go pick up your son at the baseball game, you know, those types of things. I think applications.
By the way, your son is here.
Don't leave.
I have a son. What kind of EPI is this? Yeah.
But you know, there's the. I imagine the implementation that they're using, you know, will be that developers can leverage to build into their own, to build geofencing into their own applications. I think that's where I see the value in this. Not so much another reminder app, because I'm pretty sure things will integrate that.
But the API.
But the API, a native API at that.
Yeah.
That's well, speaking of new APIs that are going to be awesome, I mean, obviously the big one is the whole iCloud announcement.
Right.
Data syncing between your application. But it's not just your application. It's your application on any device. So if you have a sibling application on the MacBook or on the iPad, the data is that synchronizing between the devices handled for you, which as a developer is pretty sweet.
Yeah, take it for me. Yeah, great.
But there are limitations to it, from what I understand. But I mean, you know, when you get free data syncing across devices, I'm not really going to fight Apple on that one.
Yeah, right.
I think you'll see it coming to a lot of things like Things. Obviously, it hasn't had a good synchronize for a while now. They rely on you both being on the same Wi-Fi network, and then you have to open one app, open up the Mac app, and then it will synchronize between the two, which isn't truly painful, but it's almost like they were waiting.
Yeah.
It is. It's almost like they were waiting for Apple to solve the problem for them, which they did. They can implement these synchronization APIs, and they'll be all set.
Well, it's better than like a Dropbox file, for example, too, because if the two machines are syncing at the same time, you could run into corruption issues, potentially.
So, yeah, the whole the iCloud and... I mean, not just the consumer impact, but from a developer standpoint, that data synchronization APIs will be wonderful, I hope.
Little things like the camera now, you have a little plus button on the volume control. I know there was a hack that someone did for...
And they
really were ticked off by making that the shutter, but now that is going to be the shutter for the camera.
Yeah, and that's definitely one that I think has come from... Maybe has been inspired by Windows Phone 7, which actually, as part of that hardware specification... For every handset, there has to be a hardware camera shutter button.
That's important for a photographer because touching the screen, you're moving that phone quite a bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is really nice. It does seem... When I read it initially, I was like, it seems like a bit of a hack. You know, they just...
It does, doesn't
they took the volume button and then... Whatever. It works. I think the other impacts are, you know, there's a more robust photo editing capabilities through the camera now. And the, you know, their grid...
Right.
Viewing, cropping, and I think they mentioned that the performance has been greatly increased. What was always one of the problems with the camera is it did take a while to load up.
To like boot up, yeah.
Yeah, especially if you were using inside your application through the API. So.
Right. The other thing is interesting that they talk about the fact that when you take a picture now, it'll synchronize. I mean, this is more consumer thing, but you know, also iCloud based.
Yes, I think there were limitations on it, you know. Someone told me 2,000 pictures, I would have to clarify. But, I mean, there were limitations. But,
yeah,
if you're getting the last X number of photos synced between all devices and then, you know, it stores them, I believe, on the Mac version as it's basically its backup for that. So
right. Any upgrades to Safari? I'm looking here.
There was some big hubbub in web development circles around position fixed and overflow auto.
Oh, okay.
We have to double check those. But fixed position fixed is implemented now in Safari browser, which is a big deal for web developers alike. So
you can put things in particular positions.
Yeah.
I mean, that's always been in the HTML spec, or at least the last
CSS3. But it's not there now.
And I didn't know they didn't support that. That's interesting. Okay. The other thing that I thought was interesting is that they actually now have the PC free feature, which is if you turn on an iPhone or turn it on an iPad, it literally says, you know, a little welcome screen, and you can connect right up to your iCloud account when you have one.
Yep.
Or create one.
Yeah, I mean, that to me was, again, very Google-esque. You know, when you open up your... the Android and Android device, it's literally, hey, what's your Google login? Oh, and you know, then it goes off and you know, build. You know, you can use your phone then and there, and they're going to implement the same thing for the iPhones. Any iPhone running iOS 5, there will be no need to sync it to your Mac, which is huge.
That's giant. I mean, actually, a lot of people, you know, for example, in the Far East, they just use phones. They don't really use computers.
Exactly.
It is a computer to them.
It is. It's their personal
elderly people.
Device.
Yeah. So we all have family members as they start to age where they don't really want a computer. They just want a tablet.
Yep.
And it's going to be huge.
And alongside that was the over-the-air updates. Which a lot of people, you know, were kind of, well, I don't want Apple telling me when I have to update. Well, trust me, when you've been having an Android device and you just get an update to your OS,
it's just there.
It's wonderful. You don't have to worry about it. And also there's kind of a nice addition there for the developers, because now we're less concerned about supporting too many revisions back because you're going to get over their updates. So the people who don't connect their phones back to their laptops and don't get notified about an OS update, they're now included. You know, now they're going to get that.
That's huge.
It is huge.
Yeah, so from a developer's perspective, that's real practical. Yeah.
It is. And then I suppose the last one in the whole syncing and PC-free is syncing of your iTunes over wireless.
Oh, yeah. And they even did a... I don't know, e-music-ish thing, or maybe that's the wrong term, or it's where you can actually pay $25 And what is it?
It's $24.99.
Yeah, like for the year, but now you're subscribing to your own music. But
well, I mean, I would be honest, when I was talking with some friends when they made that announcement, and I would have, well, don't tell Steve Jobs, I'd have gone, you know, I mean, I would have paid for the amount of music that I have stored. I mean, you know, $100 a year doesn't seem that significant when you're thinking about, hey, every piece of music that I have between my Mac and my iPhone.
It's nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you look at the iTunes, they pass an update out.
Yeah.
And even on the publicly available iTunes now, they've opened up the cloud download, which is nice. I mean,
it is.
I kind of say, you know, I'm glad they finally got around to what Amazon had.
Yeah.
So it's good to have a competition. You know?
It's the same thing that Google Music Beta is doing, right? It's the wireless availability of all your music. Right. You know, Google says, hey, we'll store it all in the cloud for us, you know, and we'll data mine it.
Of course, yeah.
But, you know,
it's marketing preferences.
You know, I mean, Apple is going to, I'm sure, find uses for the data. But, I mean, you know, for the consumer, it's awesome. I mean, it's a great addition. There was some talk between developers that maybe, you know, in terms of developer features, there wasn't enough meat for like a full point, you know, for a full point release.
Right.
And all I say is, when the NDA is lifted, you will believe otherwise.
Yes. So I'm sure there's lots hiding in there that we can't talk about.
Yeah.
If we could, we can't, because there's things called lawyers out there. So, all right. Well, let me see if there's anything else in here that refers to you. I know you have to get going, and I can just do the rest of this on my own, but let me just go to my developer news. So if you want to go to the show notes, by the way, if you want to see the Apple stuff, just go to apple.com. There's a nice banner on the beginning of the page. It says, what are the iOS 5 features? And even one on iCloud, and then something on Lion, which is the new version of OS 10. All these things are coming out in the fall. If you're an Apple developer, you can go ahead. In fact, you can go ahead and pay the $100 to become an Apple developer.
Yeah.
So if you want to play with the stuff, it's cheap.
Yep. It's all beta, though. Just forewarning before you.
Yeah, it's all beta. And actually, you cannot downgrade. So me being the tool I am, I actually did upgrade my devices, my iPad and my iPhone. And I can't talk about what I saw. But I do know now that I can't go back. So I'm bleeding edge. So.
You will be able to upgrade it as it goes through.
But, yeah, sure.
I guess the big other point for Lion want to be upgraded is it's only available, or it will only be available, through the Mac App Store for $29, $30.
Which is a pretty cheap upgrade.
It is a cheap upgrade.
Yeah.
But I guess
I wonder how that's going to perform. It's like gigabytes probably of
download.
It's
like 3-and-a-bit gig, I believe. So.
Yeah. That'll be interesting. It'll take you like 2 days to do the download.
Yeah, but it's, you know, they're obviously all gung-ho about, you know, using the Mac Store as how they're going to distribute software. So
prediction, by the end of the year, there will be downloadable, or there will be purchasable discs.
Yeah,
or an alternative download format. But
but for right now, if you want it on July or June 27th, July 27th, one of them.
Oh, it's that soon.
I thought so.
That's cool. I guess it's probably sooner than the iOS release.
Yeah, the iOS release won't take a while. Until September.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Cool. So that's at apple.com. All right. So if you want to follow along with our developer links, delicious.com/developer news/36. We're episode 36. So, let's see. Now you program in Rails, right? You're a Rails guy, kind of ish.
I was a couple of years ago.
Okay, let's convert you back to being a Rails guy for a few minutes. So I went to RailsConf this year in our upcoming prep for teaching the Rails training coming up, which you can find out about at chariotsolutions.com/education. A little plug there. There's Rails 3.1 just came out into a release candidate a couple of weeks back, actually at RailsConf. Hmm. And there's a number of things they're doing. Couple things. If you're a Rails developer, you know that by default, they ship prototype.
Yep.
And, you know, that's what they, you know, you can do whatever you want, but mm-hmm. prototype is the default. A couple things they've done in Rails 3.1. jQuery is now the default JavaScript framework that ships, which is nice because it kind of represents reality for most developers. It's the first thing you install. But also, they made jQuery the default, but you can quickly flip back. It's just like a one little line config in the config. And there's basically a gem, actually. Mm. So it's jQuery Rails and prototype Rails gems.
How's all the non-obtrusive JavaScript now in Rails 3? I know when the last time I looked at Rails 3, as it was literally putting, as they were putting the first one together, that was kind of one of their core features was now Rails 3, you know, all the inline JavaScript that was in Rails 2, they're going to rework it so it becomes, you know, unobtrusive JavaScript.
I'm not sure. I mean, I didn't see the presentation on that, but I do know one of the things they're doing is they're integrating something called CoffeeScript.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with CoffeeScript, but it's like a preprocessor for JavaScript that basically makes all the... It's kind of like a Groovy for Java.
Yeah.
You know, Groovy is the Java, as CoffeeScript is the JavaScript, except it's kind of a compiled version as opposed to interpretive, that I understand. And it might not only be that, but there is a CoffeeScript compiler. So, you know, if you go to the link we have for Rails 3.1, you can go to a link and see it's wicked simple to do the code that you would normally do in JavaScript with a little more, let's say, braces and parentheses.
Yeah.
You know, and semicolons and things like that. So they have closures. They have all sorts of nice things that they're easier to syntax. And that will be the default scripting language. It'll be installed natively by default. So you can put CoffeeScript in and it just turns it into JavaScript.
Wow.
You don't have to use it. But it's there. Another big thing that they did was they created something called the asset pipeline. So the idea there is, his complaint was, you know, Rails is very, you know, dry. You try to separate things into nice little sections, like here's all my controllers, here's all my views, here's all my, helpers and things like that. But the problem is we have this one directory, as he said, which was, public.
Yep.
And all the other crap gets heaped into public, right? So what they came out with is asset pipelines. So you can actually define now within your code areas, you can put assets like JavaScripts and CSS within those, I guess, controllers or resources, I think it is. And now it drops those in and it makes those modular as well, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, really.
And he has this thing called Sprockets 2.0. This is, I guess, the thing that actually powers this and packages this stuff together. It's a project on GitHub. So that was another thing they really talked a lot about. The other thing is they have SCSS for style sheets. Mm-hmm. So that's like, for CSS, this is like the Groovy for Java. SCSS is the simplified preprocessor for style sheets. So the best example of that is, let's say you want to use standard color schemes and you have like four colors.
Yeah.
You can define them as variables. And actually, there's this thing called SAS, which is kind of a higher level preprocessor that runs and implements the SCSS pre-compiling step.
Yeah.
So SAS is the tool. SASLang.com actually is the website, SAS-Lang.com. And that will actually go ahead and compile it into CSS from the SCSS.
I've actually been on projects where we weren't able to use something like SAS. And one of the most common complaints was like, we really need to be able to define like these color schemes as variables. Oh, you mean like SAS? Yes. But we went on a project where we could make use of that.
Early on, someone did that with JSPs on a Java project I was
really?
On. And it was, you know, they just emitted the CSS through JSPs, and then I guess they cached it or something. It's like, But, you know, that's kind of doing the same thing as this is doing. But they even have things like mix-ins and, you know, selectors, nesting of objects. So you can say a tables H1 then has a TD something or other. So you can really kind of like nest them with braces and make it look a little more programmy and easier to work with. So anyway, that's a nice little enhancement as well for Rails 3.1. They're going to support streaming. And there's a Railscast on that. If you haven't done Railscast, by the way, that kicks butt. It's been around forever. If you're a newbie to Rails, Railscast, Ryan Bates, I guess, does a lot of them, or maybe he does all of them.
I think he's done, well, everyone that I've seen, it's him. I thought it was...
Yeah, I think it's him.
I don't think there's ever been anything that I didn't want to know about Ruby or Rails and not Googled Railscast.
And you
Sphinx.
Found it.
And there he is with his tumor. But the best thing about those is they're short and they're to the point. And
5 minutes maybe.
Yeah.
10 at the most.
Yeah. He's really great at producing those. And
highly recommend those. Yeah.
Yeah. Very high quality stuff.
So number 266 is the HTTP streaming documentation there, or the example of it. And then let's see. There were some other things in here too. I mean, they have a ton of stuff in here on the... let's see, reversible migrations. So now migrations can learn, they can revert themselves, so you don't necessarily have to say remove the column,
right?
Which is really nice. Let's see, mountable engines. Let's see, engines now have their own routing and helper scope. So let's see here. I'm not sure I understand that too well. Doing this on the fly is not a good idea. So that's one of the features. Prepared statements. So now if you're doing things like Postgres or MySQL, if you're used to prepared statements in Java where it precompiles them, now Active Record is going to be able to do prepared statements, which is nice. Let's see, forcing SSL. So you can say, I want to force to go to SSL for this particular controller or for the app, which is nice. And let's see, bcrypt passwords. So you can say has secure password, and then your passwords are bcrypted.
Nice.
Things like that.
So, now there's no excuse not to roll your own authentication scheme.
Exactly, right? Custom serializers. So if you want to serialize with JSON or something, you have That's the ability nice. To do that, which is kind of nice. So, so there's a lot of stuff. They actually recorded the whole keynote. I was there for it. And it's available to watch. So that plus the slides.
Man, long live Objective-C.
So we got that going. All right, so I'm going to let you go now because I have to go at 4.
I do.
But we might have Kevin back on a future podcast if I can rope him in.
Yeah, we should do something around at least the phone gap and NFC stuff, the work that we did there. And
let's do that.
And we're working with those guys. They're very cool. If you haven't checked out Phone Gap, do so.
Yeah. Nitobi.
Yeah, you can go to phonegap.com.
Phonegap.com. Sorry. Yeah.
Any web developer who wants to write applications that can run natively, I would certainly recommend checking them out.
Cool. Awesome.
All right.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, man.
Sure. All right. Back to the dev news then. So let's go into the next thing, which is there's a little note here on web workers. So HTML5, there was a really great session on HTML5, by the way, at RailsConf that went into some of these things. But web workers are a piece of HTML5 that work on Chrome and Firefox and Safari and Opera, currently not on IE. But what they do is they let you kick off basically threads in JavaScript, you know. And so, you know, one of the things in the article that I'm putting in here from HTML5rocks.com is, you know, kind of goes in first about, you know, the issue with concurrency in JavaScript. So things like, you know, different browsers, you know, performance issues, things like that. The language is single-threaded by default. So if you think of JavaScript, it's not like Java. Java has threading built into the core of Java, and you can do things like synchronize objects, and you can kick off threads and such. But you can't do that necessarily in JavaScript. You can just kick off timers, you know, things like that, and kick off Ajax. But that's not necessarily concurrent, in that, you know, there's no synchronization. But HTML5 gives you that because they really do have threading in JavaScript. So if you have a supported browser, you can have two types of workers. You can have dedicated workers that are dedicated to a task, and you can have shared workers, which I assume are kind of like for a thread pool. And you can kick off a worker and point it to a JavaScript, the actual script itself, which is kind of cool. You can kick it off by posting a message to it. And then the script can act on things and talk to the page, and you know, you can do callbacks when it's finished and all sorts of cool stuff. So if you're interested in doing asynchrony and you support more modern browsers, you know, you can kick off these web workers and get things done. And I highly encourage you to use a library to tell you whether you've got a library to tell you whether you've got the ability to run these features. And there's a modernizer without the E, is one of those scripts. I'll have to post a link to that. Modernizer lets you actually query your browser cross-platform. Modernizer, maybe pull it up. It's an open source JavaScript library. You just include it in your code, and then you can do checks. Do I have the ability to support GPS location? Do I have the ability to support, am I a phone device? You know, what kind of features do I have? Do I have web workers? Do I have things like that? And so it's a nice little thing. You just load it up and you query your objects. So that's modernizer.com. And that way you can check for things like this. All right, so the HTML Rocks article I'll post, and also post a link to the modernizer, just so you can take a look at that nice little script. Okay, let's say you want to do remoting from your phone app or from other applications, and you want to serialize data back and forth between different things. Alex Miller from Pure Danger Tech, tech.puredanger.com, he's been a friend of the show. He runs the Strange Loop Conference, which happens every year, out in, St. Louis. And he's at Pure Danger on Twitter. Well, anyway, beyond all the other things he does, which he writes a lot about different languages, does a lot of different things, he's been taking a look at different remoting protocols and just kind of jotting down his thoughts on them. So if you're interested in ways of getting things out of some system into another, there are some different ways. For example, he points out four different projects: Protocol Buffers, which is a Google project. He points out Apache Thrift, which is a Facebook developer's project who interned at Google. And then Apache Avro, which is kind of like Protocol Buffer or Thrift, but it does things in dynamic languages more. It doesn't need a static compilation. So I think that one, for example, is driven by Hadoop. And let's see, messages are in JSON. Which, you know, again, is a little more overhead, I suppose. But there are language bindings for all sorts of languages like C, C++, Java, Python, Ruby, PHP. And RPC is types of semantics where you're calling things remotely as procedure calls are available in everything but PHP. And then if you wanted to code gen, you could do that with that one. So let's see. Apache Thrift, going back to that one. There's a custom language that the messages are defined for. Then they do a C++ compiler, which then binds for a dozen different languages. They also have RPC transport support. Cairo is a Java-specific serialization library for RPCs. It's only Java-based, and it's looking for things like high-performance Java serialization using either TCP or UDP connections. So that's if you're doing native Java, let's say. You could look at Cairo or Cairo. And so I'll post the link to the article. We use Protocol Buffers in the ETE app. ETE, Emerging Technology for the Enterprise Conference, we wanted to put an application up for Android and also one for iPad and iPhone. And so 2 years ago, we rolled out the first version of that application, kind of as a proof of concept. And we served the app as a Rails app, if I remember correctly. And then we used Protocol Buffers to take remote data and turn it into a format that we could then consume by the different applications. And at some point, we need to talk about that one. That's a nice little discussion to have. What happens is you'll run a C++ compiler again that kind of puts it in an intermediate format for Java, C, Python, and there's a number of open source plugins for that as well. So I know it was a little rambling, but if you're looking at doing remoting and you want a little bit better performance than just a pure XML or JSON approach, you can look at Protocol Buffers or Thrift or Avro or Cairo. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Okay, moving on. So the next thing we have is we are a VMware/SpringSource partner. We did that out of necessity way back when we were doing Java applications and Java EE. A couple of our developers ran into Spring, and it was a natural way of simplifying the Java EE stack, of course, and we all know what Spring is today. SpringSource was bought by VMware, and one of the reasons that VMware bought them is they wanted to try to use them as a way of kind of bootstrapping cloud environments. They know that a lot of people who are doing virtual machines in clouds are doing them for Java applications. So it's starting to bear fruit. VFabric 5 is one of two platforms for software as a service or running applications on virtualized software. The other one is Cloud Foundry. Cloud Foundry 2.0, just as a side note, was architected by Ezra Zygmuntowicz, who left EngineYard had come to work for VMware to do work on their platform. It's a Ruby-based platform, runs as a gem, and they actually have a public version of it, and you can run it privately. That's really for if you want to host Spring applications on a cloud, kind of like a Heroku-ish kind of thing, or maybe EngineYard or that kind of thing. But VFabric is more if you want to do Java apps in a private cloud where you want to run your own virtual machines and bootstrap them and give them services to be able to just deploy to. So, you know, vFabric 5 has been announced. It's next version for the vFabric platform, version 5, will basically have a bunch of Spring development tools, and it will have platform services called the vFabric platform. And so what this does is it gives you access when you boot up a virtual machine for things like TC Server, Gemfire, which is a memory data grid product like Coherence from Oracle, SQLfire, which is kind of a SQL interface for querying those things, RabbitMQ, which is a rapid messaging platform based on AMQP, which is an advanced queuing protocol, faster than JMS, a vFabric web server, which is basically an enterprise version of Apache. I guess that means it's got instrumentation and configuration running in their cloud. And then vFabric Hyperic. Hyperic is a tool they bought 2 years ago that does monitoring. So if you use one of these vFabric 5 servers, you can actually run these vFabric servers in your enterprise in a number of nodes and provision virtual machines. They're licensing this thing in late summer. They're going to license it by purchasing VMs. So you can imagine if you've got a project and you want to ramp up 3 virtual machines, they actually have the press release the prices. So their standard protocol or their standard VMware fabric, which has the basic platform, is $1,200 per VM. And then they've got a one that includes SQLfire and RabbitMQ at $1,800 per VM. So if you have advanced messaging and advanced you know, queuing, you can do that for a higher price. They'll also have a per CPU licensing model as well. Again, the reason I mention is because there's a lot of talk about public cloud and private cloud, and some people saying that private cloud isn't really cloud, and other people saying, no, it is, and it's just provisioning things inside your enterprise is just as valuable. And actually, that makes a lot of sense if you've got a lot of data that can't move off-site. Financial data, you know, sensitive data, you may not be able to run the public cloud features. So VMware kind of has a bifurcated model where Cloud Foundry is kind of their way of offering public cloud, you know, mounting the platform as a service, kind of like a Heroku-ish thing. But now they'll have this vFabric for internal cloud-based platforms. So it should be interesting to see. And I'll have a link to the InfoQ article that discusses this from Charles Humble on June 14th. And again, Chariot is a VMware partner. I have to disclose that. I don't want to, you know, make it sound like I don't have any information that, you know, we participate with them. So we do training consulting. Let's see. This one's very interesting. Oracle has been basically, when they bought Sun, they bought their VM and they bought, you know, the spec for the JDK and everything. And they own the rights to the binary and everything else. They also have licenses for it, and they license it as a binary license for Java SE6. What they've done is they've just announced on June 9th, and this is from Henrik from the JRocket project team, that they're going to be using the OpenJDK, which is the open source JDK backed by IBM, and Oracle and a number of other people, they're going to actually use that as the reference implementation and not the Sun JDK. An interesting move. And actually what they're doing, instead of the binary code license, which was what the Sun JDK and Sun RI ran on, they're going to use GPL. So that's a really interesting move for them. That means they're going to basically give you a complete GPL license for the source code, which is great. I think that's fantastic because now everyone can look at the source without having to, you know, purchase a license or saddle up and sign a license. And it's just different. So let's see. Now, I'm not sure where this puts Harmony. There is a note in here, but I haven't really read it in advance, so I don't want to say the wrong things here. So I'm not sure what they're going to be doing to Harmony or, you know, accessing the TCK for Harmony. But let's see. So they're going to be doing the RA binaries based on OpenJDK code. They're going to make the RA binaries available under the BCL license for commercial implementers. And GPL version 2, with some exception called the class pack exception, for open source implementers. And then they're going to also provide the TCK, which is their way of certifying for commercial licenses. But then they're also opening up and updating the open source OCTLA license so it covers Java SE7, which would give open source implementers free access, gratis access to verify their implementations. So that may put a Harmony in a position where Harmony could access the TCK. I'm not sure, though, because there's the whole dispute about Oracle holding off and Sun holding off on the Harmony JDK for certain reasons, which I think relates to mobile. Anyway, check out the release, the press release on that. And if you have any comments on it, we'd love to get your feedback. I'm also going to put into our notes here a note about something we talked about a couple weeks back. The last time I did a dev news, we talked about the Hudson and Jenkins back and forth. And I made some statements that weren't necessarily, I would say, correct. And I got called on it by a Twitter listener, which I thought was wholly appropriate. And I asked him to come and comment. And so he has an audio blog. Let me play that for you. It's an audio response. So hold on 1 second as I set that up.
Hey, guys. My name is Ben Darfler. I heard you guys talking about Jenkins and Hudson on the last podcast, and I wanted to help clarify a few points. First of all, you mentioned that Hudson has been donated to the Eclipse Foundation. However, it has not been donated just yet. Instead, Oracle has proposed that it be donated, and at this point, the proposal is still a work in progress. Additionally, there seems to be some confusion with the timeline. You guys mentioned that the rename happened when Kosuke left Oracle. However, Kosuke left Oracle in April of last year, but it wasn't until January of this year that the rename occurred. Finally, you implied that Kosuke unilaterally renamed the project, when in fact the community voted 214-14 in favor of the rename, after they were unable to come to an agreement with Oracle over the ownership and use of the name Hudson. At this point, the community is firmly behind the Jenkins name. One telling statistic is that of the 25 top plugins, 21 have moved to Jenkins, and the other 4 haven't had any commits since the rename. Thanks for letting me clear that up, and keep up the good work.
So that was very helpful. So guilty as charged. And I think that it's tough when you're doing this kind of like a labor of love. Sometimes you forget that people do listen to what you're saying, and you need to be accurate. So I will take that on under advisement, definitely. And I appreciate Ben's contribution. If you would like to send me any audio feedback, we would love it. As a matter of fact, the more the better. And we can do, you know, listener feedback sections of the show every week if you're interested. And I will be more than happy to put you on the air and talk to you either live or through. You can just send me an audio MP3 and I can put it online and talk about it. So thank you, Ben Darfler, for that information. All right. So let's see. We have a couple other things here. Not much, but we're wrapping up here. So on the Sonatype blog, speaking of Hudson and those things, recently Oracle and Sonatype had a Hudson user survey. I guess they were looking on their end for, you know, what was important to the Hudson project that they're going forward. And what they found was a couple of things that they brought out, and this is on the Sonatype blog, Hudson survey results. So there were three basic things that they brought up. Open source development tools are widely used by over 75% of the respondents. This illustrates the success of such tools as Hudson, Maven, and Nexus. Okay, so yeah, and we're seeing that in industry in general, that the best choice in many cases is the open source choice for some of these tools and some of these approaches. Two and three figures on there, some graphs. They were curious, like how many master and servers they were setting up, master and slave servers. And it seemed like, the smaller sites would really just have one master or maybe master and a few slaves, whereas it scaled up to large organizations using more. However, what they feel was that some number of large organizations weren't using enough slaves and missing some performance gains potential for a larger master-slave architecture. So I think they're going to get the word out on that and discuss that more. But certainly you can scale up the number of slave servers you have to, you know, get more builds going and get some more productivity through. Also, they found that there were 8 of the 29 plugins that they had listed out there. They said they were considered important by a majority. And the two top ones were the Subversion plugin and the Maven plugin. Now, I'm just going to go over here and take a look at these briefly. The top 8 were Subversion, with over 80% of the plugin users pointing that out. Maven plugin, 78 or so percent, roughly. Code analysis plugin was up there at more than 50%, but below 60. Find bugs, a little more than that, actually, or about the same. So in the 60s or in the 50s somewhere. Check style getting a little bit less, but still in the high 50s. The deploy plugin, And then M2 release. So people are doing their releases through there. And Sonar. And Sonar is one of those projects that can integrate with your Maven builds and do lots of analysis of your code, run a lot of the static analysis and take a look at dependencies and things like that, look at your code coverage, and it actually can store things in trends. So that's sonarsource.org if you're curious about that tool. So those were the top eight, and then it rolled off from there. So Maven Info was one, the Jira one. Still, all these are in the over 50% range. The Triggers plugin, Warnings, M2 Extra Steps. Git was about 50% on the nose. Then down from there, Copy Artifact, Disk Usage, Email Extensions, Violations, Tasks, Emma, Groovy. Now we're below 20% at CVS, or close to 20% rather. GitHub was 20. Mercurial was around the 20 line. So you can see where it kind of falls from there. Artifactory, then Ruby, then Grails, then ClearCase, then Perforce. Those are the ones they pulled for, or at least the ones that got results. So that's kind of interesting as well. So, that's some information from that infrastructure survey. Looks like they've actually got a link on that site on Sonatype to the press release and to the full survey results, which are out there and actually presented in, looks like, a flash presentation from January 2011. Okay, so it's been a while, but that's something they put out there. All right, and then the last one, go back here, is Ubuntu. This is also interesting, and this is long dev news, so bear with me. But Ubuntu actually recently announced, and this was on Network World from Tom Henderson and Brendan Allen, on June 13th, they announced Ubuntu 11.04, which, if you know their naming conventions, Feisty Fawn, all the other ones, they actually have one called Natty Narwhal. And they decided they're going to do a change by replacing GNOME KDE with a new user interface called Unity. There's a link in there that says, click here to see the new Ubuntu UI. Let's take a look at it here, and I'll certainly put that in the show notes. So, and this comes in as a five things we love and hate about Ubuntu 11.04 in it. So they show the Unity interface. They show kind of a file folder setup, a new file system look and feel, some media tools where they've got a Banshee media player, a disk burner called Brazero, movie player, Pitivi video editor, sound recording, Jack EQ, which looks like an equalizer, a radio tray, the ALSA mixer, and a number of other things. So they're all in one place. They've got something called LibreOffice, which is a replacement for OpenOffice. So it looks like Oracle may have abandoned it, which I wasn't aware of. But LibreOffice is their replacement in the new release of Ubuntu coming up. And let's see what else we've got. Let's see. It looks like M Collective and Cobbler, which is from Puppet Labs, or M2 Collective from Puppet Labs. So things like dealing with your replicant images. So for kind of like quick loading of the environment. Let's see. There may not be as much support for the hardware. So it looks like if you don't have the right hardware, it'll ask you for installing Ubuntu Classic, which I'm assuming would do KDE or GNOME. And then they talk about some of the things they don't like. So anyway, so that's some information about that coming in 11.04. And that's pretty much it. So I have links to all these things in the show notes page. If you like what you see on the developer news, feel free to send us feedback. Or if you don't like it, you can always hit us at TechCast on Twitter. You can email us at TechCastFeedback@ChariotSolutions.com. I'd love to have your listener feedback, your MP3 audio. If you want to send me a quick memo outranging, I'm more than happy to take them. Again, our show notes page is delicious.com/developer-news/36 in this case. You can find all this at techcast.chariotsolutions.com. And just a plug for Chariot's training and consulting services, you can find out more information about us. We do open source, Java, Ruby, Flex, and now mobile consulting We're working on platforms such as, you know, iOS, as well as Android, and now BlackBerry as well. And we look at multi-platform stuff such as, you know, HTML mobile browser applications as well. So we certainly do that. We do consulting in all of those technologies, and we also do training in Spring, in Maven, in Ruby on Rails, an upcoming course on that in August. So find more information about both of those things at chariotsolutions.com. You'll see links for the training on the bottom right, and you'll see links for all of our practices. And you can subscribe to our blog, which you'll see links for in our What We're Saying section. All right, that's it. So for the developer news, thank you, Kevin Griffin, for being there this week. Hi, Eric, if you're listening remotely. And I'll talk to you next week. This is Ken Rimple.